Chapter 16. We passed the night of our 14th day and entered our third week with a dead calm. It was one of those times in the South Seas when all nature seems to stop for breath. The air becomes oppressive, and the heat, unrelieved by the soothing trade winds, suddenly acquires weight and presses on you. Humidity rises, and the perspiration will not evaporate from your skin. In the utter lack of breeze, the sea was flat and viscous. Even the birds were listless. Only the fish were free of the torpor that descended over the world of air breathers. Without wind, the rubber raft was motionless, like the famous painted ship upon a painted ocean. I recalled the line. Most of the seabirds had left us in the night, but still following our boat was an old gray albatross of huge wingspread. He came circling about the boat, seeming to inspect us for a long while from a distance of about 100 yards. Finally, as if he had decided something, he banked steeply and shot straight in toward the boat. He landed on the water close by and calmly gazed about him like a hoary old doyen. He did not show the least fear of us, but began unconcernedly dunking his head in the water, occasionally giving us a casual sidewise glance. Eventually, he maneuvered himself to within 10 or 12 feet of the boat. Then he stretched out his long neck and poked his head into the water as deep as he could. He kept his head submerged for several seconds. He was evidently feeding on something, but I could not see what it was. I noticed that he had white feathers in the roots of his mottled tail. After several minutes, he took off and flew directly westward. I had taken in this whole show from start to finish and somehow felt much better after it was all over. I hoped we would soon have favorable winds. That was the first time I had seen the great gray albatross, but not the last. The next day he was back again, and almost every day thereafter. Sometimes he was in company with a black one. Perhaps I was becoming too imaginative, but the appearance of the gray albatross always impressed me uncomfortably. Later events convinced me that this was indeed a bird of evil omen. As a result of the recent rains, our pistol now was rusted beyond repair. Previously, I had been able to insert a shell by hand and force the gun closed, in this way firing one round at a time, but rust and corrosion finally won. The gun had rusted so badly during the days when we were unable to clean it because of continuous rain that it had become almost one solid piece of metal. Tony, by exerting all his strength, was able to remove parts that we thought we might be able to use in improvising fish spears or some other implement to arm us if we should land on an uninhabited island. He then drew out the barrel, with a hard struggle, to make as great a length as possible of barrel and frame. We left the gun in this position to rust solid, thus making a passable hammer. This, we figured, would come in handy for breaking open shellfish, coconuts, or other edibles that we might be fortunate enough to find on an island. Our pliers and pocket knife, our most useful tools, were not so severely affected by corrosion as was the gun, which was a better grade of steel. That night we talked some about our plight, which was growing worse every minute that we were without favorable wind. Sundown brought a little comfort, but it was not cool. It was less hot. The 15th day dawned on a torpid sea. As the morning wore on and I saw no signs of the calm lifting, I began to wish we had some means of rowing. Our strength was a little less with each foodless day, and I felt it necessary that we should make some sort of progress. Besides, rowing would give us something to do. Hour after hour we had gazed at the sluggish sea from our reddening eyes, seldom speaking, seldom smiling. Activity might be a tonic to our dulling spirits. I looked over our stock of gear for some means of improvising oars. The inventory didn't take long. Finally, my eyes lit upon my shoes, which I was still saving. I studied them thoughtfully. The only possibility was there. "Jean," I said, "give me the knife." He turned his head slowly, after a moment, without interest. "Give me the knife," I repeated. He handed it to me and turned back to his contemplation of the silent sea. My shoes had thick live rubber soles and low heels. With the knife I cut away the uppers of one shoe, slicing off the leather flush around the heels, but leaving about a half inch of the uppers attached around the toe. This formed a sort of cup, and was also to act as reinforcement to keep the sole from bending backward under pressure of the water. When the upper part was carved away to my satisfaction, I drilled a hole in one side of the instep. I passed the shoestring through this hole, evened up the ends of the cord, and tied it down with a square knot. I then tied another square knot in the joined outer ends of the strings. This formed a permanent loop that could be passed about the wrist of the rower, so that if he inadvertently dropped the shoe, it would not be lost. After finishing the first shoe, I moved over to the forward thwart, sat down, and tried it out. "Glory be," I whispered. My scheme was going to work. I could dip the shoe into the water and, pushing backward, create a perceptible forward drive. It worked exactly like a small canoe paddle, except that my arm was the handle. In a few minutes, I had made another paddle from the other shoe, and thus I created our motive power. "Look alive, lads," I shouted, elated with accomplishment. "We're going places." When the boys saw that my idea would work, their listlessness vanished. This new control over the raft that we had achieved was like a weapon placed in the hands of a fallen man. "Let's get a-goin'," Gene said, enthusiastic now. I believe it was Gene and I who started. Gene was on the starboard side and I on the port. In 15 minutes, we had stretched awake behind us. "You rest now, Gene," I said. "Your turn, Tony." Gene moved back to the stern to rest. I slid over to his place. Tony took my former position at port and rowed with a will. After 15 more minutes, as nearly as we could judge, I went aft for my rest. Tony moved to starboard and Gene came in at port. Thus we spelled each other, circling counterclockwise. All that day we rowed, never stopping, until about 2 o'clock the next morning, almost 18 hours. As I had hoped, action raised our spirits. We chatted gaily, even tried a shanty or two. We exchanged all the lore we had on the art of rowing, or paddling as you will. Sometimes the man resting in the stern acted as coxswain, counting the stroke and calling hilariously for 10 big ones for dear old Harvard. 15 minutes rest for each man as he finished his half-hour shift kept us fresh. Shifting from one side to the other every 15 minutes kept us from straining either arm. At that, it was rather tiring without food to sustain our strength. A sparing swig of warm water from the diminishing supply in the little rubber bag was welcome refreshment. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, a breeze sprang up from the east, driving us on in the direction we had been rowing all day and night. We were quite fatigued by now and were elated that the sudden risen wind should keep sending us in exactly the direction we wanted to go. We shipped oars gratefully and composed ourselves to rest as best we could for the remainder of the night. The exercise had quickened our minds as well as our blood, and we were quite optimistic as to our chances of reaching one of the larger islands that we knew to be off to the westward. Before closing my eyes to try to doze, I checked our progress by the stars. We had rowed 100 miles. The next day, however, we lost all that we had gained.